Welcome to Today on Broadway for Saturday, April 29th, 2017. Yeah. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway Star's James Marino.
So, sorry about that, James.
I had a little
bout of the food poisoning. That was not so bueno.
We were very concerned about you.
Yes, oh, I'm sure. Yes, let's just say I went to a show on Thursday night and had a yummy dinner, and I refused to blame the following hours of praying to the porcelain gods on Shake Shack. I will not allow my mind to think that, because I don't ever want to think about that when I go to Shake Shack, but I have no better explanation, because by midday on Friday, I was perfectly fine. But man, it was touch and go there for a while before that.
You know, you don't have the New York City resistance built up to you. You know, folks who live in New York City regularly, we lick the pole in the subway. That way it builds up our resistance type of things.
Exactly. You live in a rough and tumble city. I live down here where, you know, they serve emu legs at Disney and stuff. So, you know, whatever. That's not true. People don't. I know that's not true. It's a joke.
All right. So let's catch up on what we missed. And also at the end of this podcast, we're going to have what?
You're going to have, I believe you're doing an interview with a very special guest about an upcoming concert production, right? I think that's why you're talking to him.
So, yes, we are going to talk to Rob Fisher about the 92nd Street Y's Lyrics and Lyricist series, which he's going to be doing very soon. So at the end of this podcast, take a listen to that interview. First up, let's talk about what the critics had to say about A Doll's House Part 2.
Yeah, since this is a weekend show, James, we're a little bit more laid back. You've got an interview at the end, so we're just going to go through just the 90,000 foot view of this. We won't go through all the reviews, but needless to say, they were all pretty dang good. As you probably know by now, A Doll's House Part 2 opened on Thursday night at the John Golden Theater, written by Lucas Hanath and directed by Sam Gold. The show stars Laurie Metcalf, Chris Cooper, Jane Houdyshell, and Condola Rashad. The story picks up about 15 years after the original Henrik Ibsen play A Doll's House, where Laurie Metcalf's character, Nora, storms out of her family home, slams the door, and breaks out of the quote-unquote doll's house that she's been living at in the patriarchal society of some Scandinavian country. I can't remember what country it was. But anyway, this play picks up 15 years later. Nora is now an acclaimed author writing under a pseudonym, a feminist author. And apparently people are loving it, James, despite the fact that nobody is going to see it. Ben Brantley of the New York Times wrote, quote, "A door that once slammed so hard that the noise could be heard around the world is now being knocked upon, most insistently. In the opening moments of Lucas Hanath's smart, funny, and utterly engrossing new play, which opened Thursday night at the Golden Theater, audience members laugh at the sound of the demanding tattoo being beaten upon that door. That's because they have probably guessed who's on the other side. That is indeed our Nora, who is knocking so boldly for readmittance and is subsequently ushered in by the old Helmer family retainer, Anne Marie, Jane Houdyshell, fabulous as usual. As embodied by Miss Metcalf in a performance exquisitely poised between high comedy and visceral angst, Nora is looking nervous, yes, but also mighty prosperous and pleased with herself." Brantley continues, "Mr. Hanath approaches what might seem like a hubristic project with the humility and avidity of an engaged every reader. A Doll's House Part 2 gives vibrant theatrical life to the conversations that many of us had after first reading or seeing its prototype, conducted in our own minds," or this is a weird pull quote from Mr. Brantley, "or perhaps over blunts and beers in dorm rooms." Slap that up on a poster, Mr. Rudin. Despite the fact that Brantley gives us an inside look into his college life, it's a great review. Some other ones real quick. Matt Winman of AM New York wrote, "It's apparently never too late to create a sequel, even to a Norwegian domestic drama written more than a century ago." Lucas Hanath, who had two of his plays, The Christians and Red Speedo, produced last year by major off-Broadway companies to great acclaim, now makes his Broadway debut with the lightweight but feisty comedy A Doll's House Part 2. Charles Charles McNulty of the LA Times loved it as well. Maya Stanton of Entertainment Weekly, Jeremy Gerard loved it as well. He wrote, "The last show to open on Broadway this season turns out to be the funniest and the sharpest play of the year, which is a pleasure to report." James, we kind of anticipated that this would be one that the critics liked, despite the fact that it seems like nobody is going. So do you think they'll take some of these pool quotes aside from Mr. Brantley talking about blunts and beers and try to turn that into some semblance of a marketing campaign?
I think that their marketing folks are advertising, have a big advertising campaign going on over at Friendster. So I'm sure that'll translate into
I've seen a lot of ads on MySpace. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So that's always good. You know, they're coming back. I'm telling you, they're big in the Philippines. Friendster's big in the Philippines, which is a
is that
big,
true?
Is that
true?
Musical. Yeah, I actually, totally tangential is it's not Reply All. It's Startup. The Startup podcast is featuring Friendster, which put it in my head.
Oh, and are they really? I haven't listened. Yeah,
they've got a 4 or 5 part series on Friendster and how the company started and the trajectory and the competition between MySpace and Facebook, and it's a very interesting thing. And they talked about how Friendster got this huge, huge uptake in the Philippines, and it was bad for the business model because it slowed down the site. They didn't have, you know, AWS and servers on demand and things like that, so it slowed down the site, and it wasn't good for demographics. The advertisers didn't really want to advertise to the Philippines, and it was part of, you know, things that went wrong at Friendster for 100, Alex. So anyway,
Friendster's big in the Philippines, and Germans love David Hasselhoff.
Exactly. So back to A Doll's House Part 2.
Right, which makes it's a perfect segue back to the topic at hand.
I'm seeing it this week, and I hear great stuff about it from theater insiders. But, you know, this is perhaps a victim of such a huge, great, loud musical Hello, Dolly season. That is, the Hello Dollys, the Dear Evan Hansons, the big shows that are taking up all the oxygen in the room. And maybe Doll's House is going to fall victim to that. I hope not, because this has been a great season for plays as well as it has been a great season for musicals. We'll have to see what happens here. And maybe not this Monday, but next Monday or the Monday after, when we look at grosses, we'll have an understanding of whether the critics are able to get this message out to the folks there. All right. Next up, the Drama Desk announces the 62nd annual awards nominations.
James, before we get into the awards, did you watch the live stream of the announcements? Probably not, because you were probably on the go on Friday.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a Drama Desk member, and I didn't realize that this was happening, but...
talked about it, but
we talked about it.
Let me just tell you, you don't pay attention to me. I totally understand. We're like a married couple. Anyway, the two people who introduced the nominations and revealed the nominations were Hamilton's Javier Munoz and Laura Benanti, who I can't tell you just how great it was to see her again. She's been out of the public eye, both on social media and otherwise, since, I don't remember, maybe around November or October. She obviously had a baby on Valentine's Day. I was talking to her publicist yesterday and just saying, man, it was so good to see her. She was hilarious as always and self-deprecating. So that was great. But the most important things are, as they announced the Drama Desk nominations, obviously, full disclosure, one of the Drama Desk nominators is Broadway Radio's own Peter Felicia. So if you don't like the nominations, yell at him, not us. Okay, so let's talk about some of these. In the Outstanding Play category, we had the nominees If I Forget, Indecent, A Life, Oslo, and Sweat, Outstanding Musical, Anastasia, The Band's Visit, Come From Away, Hadestown, and The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, Outstanding Revival of a Play, The Front Page, The Hairy Ape, Jitney, The Little Foxes, Master Harold and the Boys, and Picnic, Outstanding Revival of a Musical, Falsettos, Hello Dolly, Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, Sweet Charity, and Tick, Tick, Boom. Let's run through some of these Outstanding Actor and Actress categories. In a Play, Outstanding Actor, Bobby Cannavale, Daniel Craig, Kevin Kline, Klein, David Hyde Pierce, John Douglas Thompson, outstanding actress in a play, Kate Blanchett, who we'll talk about here in a second, Laura Linney, Laurie Metcalf, Amy Ryan from Love, Love, Love off-Broadway, and Harriet Walter from The Tempest at St. Anne's Warehouse. Outstanding actor in a musical. This is an interesting category here, James, because it's quite a bit different from some of the other off-Broadway and Broadway nominations we've seen before. Outstanding actor in a musical, Nick Blamire for Tick, Tick, Boom, John Briones from Miss Saigon, Nick Cordero from A Bronx Tale, Andy Carl from Groundhog Day, and Jeremy Seacom from Sweeney Todd. Outstanding actress in a musical, Christy Altimer from Anastasia, Christine Ebersole from War Paint, Sutton Foster from Sweet Charity, Patti LuPone from War Paint, Bette Midler from Hello Dolly, and Laura Osnes in Bandstand. Obviously, we'll have all of the nominations in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. But James, when you have a small group of people, kind of nominating shows from both Broadway and off-Broadway, you're liable to get some. I don't want to say controversy, but disagreement. And there's some things there to pick apart. But for the most part, it's a great slate of shows honoring the best of Broadway and off-Broadway for the year.
You also have to. I don't listen to you, but did you remind the listeners that things like Dear Evan Hansen
yes.
weren't nominated?
I did not. But like some of these other ones we've talked about in recent days, Dear Evan Hansen, Significant Other, Natasha Perry and the Great Comet of 1812, a lot of these shows that had been eligible for awards in previous seasons are not eligible this year unless there are additional elements added, which is one of those things, again, where we haven't seen Josh Groban nominated. We haven't seen Danae Benton nominated, which is odd because they are technically eligible for these awards. So I wonder if they're kind of getting swept up and people kind of not thinking about Natasha Pierre, or if maybe that'll be a harbinger for what happens in the Tony Awards and they get snubbed as well. But the entire production of Dear Evan Hansen is not eligible. But, you know, we've seen this in years past, even last year, where Hamilton wasn't eligible for Drama Desks, and everyone kind of was like, oh, I wonder what this means. You know, how we don't really know what it means for the Tonys, and it swept everything. So I would imagine that this doesn't really hurt or say anything about Dear Evan Hansen's chances.
Oh, my goodness. Is Hamilton only a year away?
It started performances in July of 2015. So it was, you know, it was almost open for a year.
Yeah,
by the
time
the Tonys came. So,
all right, what's up in other award news?
Well, we're going to run through these really quickly, but a few days ago, the Tony Awards announced that they would be giving their Lifetime Achievement Award to James Earl Jones, obviously one of the most prolific and accomplished actors on both stage and screen. He is a two-time Tony winner. Obviously, he is as known as much for anything as his screen roles and his voice roles, and obviously as the voice of CNN, which is where most people know him from, obviously. But this is a great honor. We'll talk about this more, I'm sure, as it gets closer to the Tony Awards. Speaking of lifetime achievements, the Obie Awards, the American Theater Wing and the Village Voice, announced that they would be giving their Lifetime Achievement Award to Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who just so happened to make her Broadway debut this year, Paula Vogel. Those will be handed out on May 22nd. I'm sure we'll talk about that as well. And this really isn't award news, but earlier this week during the Babes in Toyland concert from Master Voices, they announced that they would be establishing the Roger Reese Fund for Musical Theater, honoring the late stage and film and television actor and director who passed away so tragically a year or so ago. The Reese Fund will support the group's future musical theater projects devised and selected by artistic director Ted Sperling, who was introduced to the organization by Reese himself. So a nice little way to come full circle for that organization. And I was just thinking about Roger Reese the other day when it's a really tangential thing, but the Percy Jackson musical made me think of him because it's based on a Disney Hyperion novel, as was Peter and the Starcatcher, which Roger Reese co-directed. So I was thinking about him the other day, even before this. But a nice little thing for Master Voices to do in his honor.
Okay, and what's up in the show and casting news?
Again, we're going to just kind of run through these as quickly as possible, but Baz Bamaboy of the Daily News has reported that Academy Award-winning actor and potential Tony nominee Kate Blanchett has signed on to play the role of Margot Channing in a stage adaptation of the classic film All About Eve. The adaptation, which will be directed by, shocking, I know, Tony Award winner Ivo Van Hove, is expected to arrive on the West End in 2018. The play will be produced by Sonia Friedman Productions and Fox Stage Productions, James, just another show for Ivo Van Hove to direct. I guess we shouldn't be surprised at this point. After that, we also found out on Friday from Manhattan Theater Club that two-time Olivier Award nominee Michael Xavier, currently starring opposite Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard, will round out the cast of Prince of Broadway, which will begin its limited engagement on August 3rd and open officially on August 24th at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater. We knew that there was one spot open, and as we talked about at the time, James, this is the role, apparently, the track that Ramin Karimloo had played in Japan when the show made its world premiere. Obviously, Anastasia is still running, so Ramin couldn't do that. So it looks like they got another smolderingly handsome man with a full head of hair. Jerk. Anyway, also on Friday, Lincoln Center Theater announced that Tasha Lawrence, Morocco Amari, Karen Pittman, who is fantastic on both stage and screen, Namir Smallwood, Jamie Lincoln Smith, and Heather Velasquez will be featured in its upcoming production of Pipeline, a new play by Dominique Morceau, directed by Liliana Blaine Cruz, which begins performances Thursday, June 15th at the Mitzi Newhouse Theater. In the play, Naya Joseph, played by Pittman, is a dedicated inner-city public high school teacher who is committed to her students' achievement while she sends her only son, Omari, played by Smallwood, to a private boarding school. When Omari is involved in a controversial incident which threatens him with expulsion from his school, Naya is forced to reconcile Omari's rage and her own personal parenting decisions as she rallies to save her son. Anytime you can get Karen Pittman back on stage, it's a good thing, in my opinion. Also, last week we found out that Justin Guarini will be appearing as Vincenzo in the Muni's upcoming production of The Unsinkable Molly Brown, which will run from July 21st through the 27th. As we've talked about many times, this show will star Beth Malone and many others and be directed by Kathleen Marshall. This is the second or third time these two have worked on a production of this show, which has always been rumored for a Broadway transfer. I don't know if this is something that would do well in a commercial setting, but getting hooked up with a not-for-profit theater company and doing Unsinkable Molly Brown on Broadway would definitely be something that I think a lot of people would love, especially getting Beth Malone back on Broadway. And then finally in this section, straight off the success of La La Land, Damien Chazelle, the writer and director behind that film, is setting his sights on television. He is attached to direct and show run a new musical drama set in a multicultural Paris called The Eddy. The show revolves around a club, its owner, the house band, and the volatile city that surrounds it. The show is being called a musical drama, so you expect a lot of music, which obviously Damien Chazelle did wonderfully, but not only in La La Land, but in his previous Academy Award nominated and winning film, Whiplash, with former Broadway guy and Buckeye J.K. Simmons. So a lot of stuff in there, a lot of good stuff, and that's good because that's a lot of fun stuff. Our last story is not so much fun, but a lot of good shows to look forward to coming down the pike.
Well, next up, we have the news that David Cody, the chief theater critic over at Time Out New York, is no longer the chief theater critic at Time Out New York.
Yeah, this is you actually texted me when you first saw this, even before kind of the news had broken. But apparently, due to some restructuring, David Cody wrote, I think this came from his Facebook page, that he just learned that after 17 years, Time Out New York was restructuring, and effective immediately, he was out of a job. He had been the longest serving theater editor in New York City. And I don't know, James, on the heels of this and Linda Weiner resigning from Newsday, it just feels weird. You throw this in with Charles Isherwood being fired. Obviously, much different circumstances for all three of these people, but it just feels like it's a seismic kind of change. And I don't know what it means, if anything, especially in the day and age when theatrical criticism no longer holds as much weight as it once did. But it feels, maybe it feels bigger for us who are kind of inside the community, but it just feels like something's going on, and I'm not 100% comfortable with what that is.
So I don't want to end on a downer, so I'm going to throw something in that's not in the script.
Okay, bring it.
That's sort of related to this. Now, our good friend Carrie Purcell, who is a features writer, really not, I think most of her writing that we see published is not in the criticism area, but in the features area. She was a features editor at Playbill, has written for many, many different places, including Huffington Post and a number of other outlets, has her first piece in the New York Times today. And I would love everybody to get over and check it out. It's called 10 Years Later, A One-Woman Show Is Still One Man's Work by Carrie Purcell in the New York Times.
Good for her.
So it's about the show Dixie's Tupperware Party, and it's 10-year run so far. You know Dixie's Tupperware Party?
I do. I didn't see it, but it was here in town, I think last fall maybe, here in Orlando. And it's, yeah, I've seen a lot of the promotional stuff. That's hilarious. Yeah.
So we're just so excited for Carrie to have achieved her first byline in the New York Times. Congratulations, Carrie, and get over and take a read. She's such a wonderful writer and a great person. I ran into her last night at Bandstand, and she was just so excited, and all the press reps and everybody were congratulating her. So from Broadway Radio, we congratulate Carrie as well.
Absolutely.
All right, why don't you get us out of here?
All right, thanks for listening to Today on Broadway in an unusual slot on a Saturday. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio, and you can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt, and subscribe to Something Got Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. James, you have a Tony Award winner on Sundays this week on Broadway, I believe, right?
Sundays this week on Broadway, we are going to be talking with Frank Wood. So check us out. Peter, Michael, and I will be chatting with that and talking about some of the shows we've seen. I've seen Bandstand, Anastasia, Dolly, and Charlie just this week alone. So
it's a hard knock life.
Yeah, it's a hard knock life for us. So thanks for listening to a special episode on Saturday. Stay tuned for our interview right following this segment, and we will talk to you on Sunday at This Week on Broadway, or on Monday back with Today on Broadway. With us today, we have a very special guest. Rob Fisher is joining us by telephone, and we're going to talk about the Lyrics and Lyricists series up at the 92nd Street Y, where he is the guest artistic director for one of these shows. So, Rob, thank you for joining us on a Saturday morning and talking about this.
Oh, I'm happy to. All I have to do is Xerox a whole ton of new vocal arrangements and get to rehearsal.
So tell us about this show.
Well, it came to be, Sheldon Harnick and I have done 8 of these together, and we looked for excuses to collaborate. Uh-huh. Sunday, this very Sunday, is his 93rd birthday.
Yes.
And just yesterday I told him he's my Energizer Bunny, because he wrote half the script in the last couple of days. He's just incredibly prolific for anybody at any age. But we've done several lyricists that he's admired. He's given us lots of insights into lyrics he's written over the years. This year the idea came up. First he was wanted to spend some time talking about the lyrics of Leo Robin, who wrote Thanks for the Memory and all the songs in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, the lyrics for all the songs. And it seemed like we needed a bigger idea. So it turned into, it's sort of like, who has hacked our brains with lyrics? Because if you start saying the lyrics to As Time Goes By, You Must Remember This, A Kiss Is Just a Kiss, or Thanks for the Memory, those lyrics are in our head. Or When You Wish Upon a Star, those lyrics live in all our heads. And if I say, well, who wrote the lyrics for As Time Goes By? Very few people can answer. And when I say it's Herman Hupfeld, that's no help.
and that's true of a lot of the early Disney songs.
It's very true of the Disney songs. It turns out what's come through as a common thread for a lot of these songs is that they're from movies. And the fact that movies have endured means that multiple generations have gotten these songs in their heads.
Sure.
And there's also this weirdness that the movie songwriting teams never became branded teams the way the Broadway teams did. And so we know less about them, and they also changed partners frequently. Harry Warren, the composer, wrote with several of our lyricists. So we're focusing on 5 lyricists who qualify for having gotten lyrics stuck in our brains. And and Harry wrote with most of them, but they, for about 25 years from the 30s into the 50s, they had nominated Oscar songs every year and won many years. And it's, and then there was this other common theme. I found a photograph. I would love to find it on my table right now, because it had our main three lyricists we started out to talk about are Al Dubin, Matt Gordon, and Leo Robin. And there was this photo we found with them standing next to each other.
Oh, my God.
And also in the photo is Harry Revel, who wrote with Matt Gordon. And there's a fantastic video of them from the 30s with Matt Gordon, who's a great big heavy man, dancing light on his feet and singing in a beautiful tenor voice. But it also has Harry Warren in it and Hoagy Carmichael in it, who also wrote with these guys. And then Larry Hart just happens to be sitting there too. Anyway, it's a fantastic photo that we're, I want to put on the screen a few times, because I don't know of another time or place other than Hollywood at that time where these guys just all hung out together, recombined as different songwriting teams, and produced all these amazing songs that now just live in our head.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've had that experience of not, you know, and I think I'm fairly knowledgeable about this stuff, but still there are things, songs that I, if you asked me who wrote them, I couldn't necessarily come up with it immediately. And it's not always the lyricist, too. Sometimes it's the composer, as is the case with
But
this
I bet it's more common if it's a non-theater song, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, because, mm-hmm. right, because, yes, absolutely. Do you know this? Here's a Leo Robin credit that's so obscure, Rob, that you may not even know it. Do you know that he wrote the lyrics for a movie called Gulliver's Travels?
Nope.
This is a 1930...
Does it have any songs we know?
Not that we know. It's a 1939 animated film, Max Fleischer. The background music, they call it atmospheric music. Basically, the background score is by Victor Young. But the songs are by Ralph Ranger and Leo Robin.
Well, Ralph wrote Thanks for the Memory, you know, and it was soon thereafter that song came along. And they were, that was his first big collaborator, was Ranger. And then, but back, and he also wrote with Whiting, Richard Whiting, Beyond the Blue Horizon. And then his third big one was Julie Stein for shows like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. He chose his, he also, we're doing one song he wrote with Harold Arlen that Judy Kuhn is doing. It was written in the stars, which is this weird, minor, obscure, but gorgeous thing that only Harold Arlen could write and is like, perfect for the Judy Kuhn sensibility.
Well, you know, I'm looking on IMDb, Internet Movie Database, for Leo Robin, and it says known for, and then it gives like your most famous credit. Guess what it lists for Leo Robin?
Well, I hope Thanks for the Memory is there, but
no, this would be a movie title. Fight Club. I guess they use a song of his in Fight Club.
Yeah. That seems an odd thing to say, because we don't know that movie, I don't think.
Well, some of us do, not me.
This is exactly why these series at the 92nd Street Y are important for us to do. You are doing this next Saturday, May 6th at 8 p.m., Saturday, Sunday, and Monday over at the 92nd Street.
A total of 5 performances. It's a killer weekend, but I have such a great, strong cast and band. Everybody's super. The song list turns out to be just a great song list. We're doing the well-known songs, the brain hacks that each of these guys have done, and then Sheldon's talking more about how these guys worked, and we're doing some of their lesser-known songs just as a way to get to know these guys who live in our heads and we'd never met before.
So talk about your cast. Aaron Finley, Judy Kuhn, Elizabeth Stanley, Sal Viviano.
Well, I wanted a quartet that could cover... they needed to each be individually versatile, but then cover everything. And we've just been in rehearsal for a couple of days, and I couldn't be happier, because not only are they great singers, they're enthused about the lyrics and what you want at a lyrics and lyricist show is to present the lyrics in a way that an audience can engage with. And with Sheldon's explanation, it's just, I find these shows a way to make our ears better, and that's kind of my goal with these. Some of these songs will be familiar, but we can always listen better and glean more, and especially with Sheldon's instruction. And then each of these, Aaron I had not worked with before, but just has this has this beautiful old-fashioned, like, production tenor voice, which is so appropriate for some of this stuff. Sal sounds like Sinatra or any of those 40s big band guys, and a lot of this stuff comes from that material. Elizabeth is like one of the most versatile singers ever.
Yes.
And also a brilliant musician. I can throw anything at her, and she can sing it in any key and any character. And Judy is, you know, in a class by herself, who is a great dramatic singer and an official Disney princess from having Pocahontas. So it's just between the four of them, we can do whatever we want. And I'm pulling them together because some of this is big band era. They're doing some tight harmony vocals on some things. It turns out Mac Gordon wrote the lyrics for both Chattanooga Choo Choo and I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. So I'm putting them together as a little like medley of places with funny names, but they're such classic big band songs. We're going to kind of come at them from that angle.
Those are great songs, both of them. I love them so much. And I've always said, honestly, that Leo Robbins' lyrics for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes are among the best ever, and I've always been sorry that he didn't do more shows like that.
Absolutely. Because they're so full of what we want the character to say, and they're just brilliant.
They really are.
Really, really special. He's one of the more educated guys of this gang of guys. And he's in the photographs. He's the only one not smoking a cigar. Just the rest of them just have cigars all the time.
So Rob,
I don't know what that says about him and his ability to do lyrics. We are going to do "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend" because it is just laden with the wittiest rhymes and images of a very endearing gold digger, you know?
Yes.
I told Elizabeth, because she's like maybe the only person that could pull it off, we should pair that with Glitter and Be Gay sometimes, because they're based on the same song, and she can sing both of them. That won't be on this concert, folks. You'll tune in another time.
Other time.
Let me change gears for a second. We're talking about other people's work so much. Let's talk about Rob Fisher for a second and your work that arranging all of that music for An American in Paris. And what was that like? Because the huge undertaking of 2.5 hours of wall-to-wall music, that how long did you work on that for?
Thank you for noticing, because it was, I guess it was 4 or 5 years of developing it. And
some of the greatest music ever.
Yes.
Yeah, and the Gershwin family opened up all the songs and all the concert music to us, and I spent a long time with Craig Lucas and Christopher Wheeldon, the writer and director, going through all of it and talking about how it might be used either for dance or visual or what songs might come out of the mouths of what characters. And so, and it was all developed together with the character, with the song, and then the song affected the character. And how could we get those three boys to follow a similar track and share songs? And that creative process was absolutely fantastic. The doing of it is a little harder when you get into production and stuff. And also, Christopher, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this, tends to change his mind frequently, as in daily. And when he'd change, then I would have to, that night, rewrite music to then have the next day in rehearsal. So it was a grind to get it just right. And that a lot of that is in the scene changes, the fact that it is continuous and flowing from beginning to end, and in collaboration with the set designers, lighting designers, projection designers, so that it all flows as one. It meant lots of adjustments to music and staying in George Gershwin's voice at all times. And I feel pleased and satisfied it is George's voice all the time. But it was a big one in my life, that, you know, it's kind of a monument to that, to my relationship with the Gershwins in that show. But I'm extremely proud. It's doing great on the road. And just opened in London to 23 five-star reviews. And Robbie Fairchild's over there, our lead from Broadway. And the ballet star is there for 3 months to get it going. And people are loving it in London. I think I'm going over in a couple of weeks, but I hear that they're reacting to jokes. That they're just getting, like, explosive response every show, every night.
Well, I mean, you spent 4 to 5 years on this thing, and the end result is just amazing that you've got there. It again highlights the fact that the musical supervisors and arrangers and things like that are not often recognized during the awards season, and I think that that's a terrible transgression that hopefully... a music supervisor will be recognized in the future.
Well, we got sound designer back, yeah, so we got anything can happen.
Right. And orchestrations. The American in Paris won for orchestrations, and it was split between Christopher Austin and Bill Elliott, but I supervised all the notes they wrote. Yeah. So I felt good that work had been acknowledged. I didn't particularly need to get up there on stage, but I was glad people noticed. But it's hard. I mean, the big thing about it is the terms music director and conductor and music supervisor, arranger, and they're too obscure for the general public out in the world to understand the differences. And there's no... Unless you look at billing, there's almost no way to know how much somebody did. If it's a brand new show, I understand why it's hard to make a category, because. But I would accept a special Tony for all that work if you want.
Okay,
I think that's a perfect solution.
Well, Rob, we'll let you run. We know you have a full Saturday ahead of you, but thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio. To remind everybody, the Lyrics and Lyricists Unsung Lyricists series at the 92nd Y is coming up next weekend, Saturday, May 6th, Sunday, May 7th, and Monday, May 8th for 5 shows. We'll have links to this in the show notes so that you can get your tickets and get over there and check it out. Rob, thanks you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio again. We appreciate it.
It's really fun to talk to you, Michael. I hope it won't be too long till the next one.
Yes. Yes, sir.
All right.
Have
Bye-bye.
A great day.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thank you.